How's everybody doing? And good to have you with us again this afternoon. My guest today is Brent Winters. You know him as a common lawyer. He has been on the show before, and so we're very, very thankful that he had some time today to join us. And topic of today has, which has been kind of brewing for a long time, and we're going to be talking about militias. And Brent is doing some work with the militias in Virginia.
Talks about, well, actually, three of them grant duties, delegate responsibility to three classes of persons, namely, congressmen of the United States, second, presidents of the United States. Another clause delegates responsibility to state governors and state legislators. And then the last militia clause, the one that folk know about, it delegates no responsibility at all, and that's the Second Amendment. It simply declares that it will protect a particular duty that men have, able-bodied men, to keep and carry firearms. That is not an option under our law, never has been. We've ignored it for 175 years, but it's a duty. Justice Joseph Story, Supreme Court Justice of the United States Supreme Court, the longest serving justice, I believe he was appointed at such a young age, age 32. And then after about 39 years of shakedown experience with our Constitution of the United States, in other words, 39 years after our country ratified the Constitution, he wrote a set of commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. And in those commentaries concerning the Second Amendment, which, remember, delegates no duties, it simply recognizes a fundamental right. That's all government can do with fundamental rights.
Well, it also recognizes, it basically says the government, it does say that the government has hands off.
Well, excellent point. In recognizing that right, it declares that the government will not infringe.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government, thanks for stressing that point. But the point that I'm stressing also with that is that it delegates no duties. This is fundamental to understanding the militia clauses of our Constitution, because the militia of the several states is not something you volunteer into. It's something you're born into. When you're born, God has given certain rights to certain people. That means certain responsibilities. And for example, the First Amendment, we call these fundamental rights. These are rights that God has given direct to the individual with no intermediating government or institution or church denomination or emperor or university, no authority between the government and the individual. And I say individual. This is not a group matter until the individuals respond to the individual duty, the subpoena that their maker has given to them, to answer the call to protect themselves, their homes, their families, their neighbors, and their country. That's what this is. The authority for it, we find in the books of Numbers, mostly the book of Numbers, in the Bible, the fourth of the writings of Moses, and the book called Deuteronomy, the fifth writing of Moses. Those outline in detail the duties of the militiamen of the 12 several tribes of Israel. And that law that is given there in that land deed called Deuteronomy and Numbers, all taken together, give us the first principles of the militia. And never before in the recorded history of Adam's race has any people had a more detailed law concerning the militia, as has Israel. The only nation that has had such a law that is even comparable in any way is the United States of America. Now, in England, where our common law is said to have arisen in its modern form, but I hasten to add that it didn't arise there. It arose on the north of the continent of Europe among the Germanic and Scandinavian and Celtic tribes, as far as recorded history goes. They've always had a militia, and the fundamentals of our militia that we have, according to our United States Constitution, are the fundamentals of the common law militia. Anciently, the Anglo-Danes called the militia on the Isle of Britain before the Norman invasion of 1066, and its fundamentals are the same that we have today, called it the Ferd Fair. Now, let me back up a minute. Two things I've missed here. Number one, I want to say that our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. How do I know? Because I read it and look at it and look at history and read and put it together, and it's obvious. But I'm in good company when I say that. Supreme Court Justice Taft made that observation, as have many other justices in our common law world through the centuries. Justice Taft said that our Constitution of the United States is a common law document of government in compact draft. That's fact. And it doesn't explain anything. It talks about the jury. It doesn't talk about it. It just mentions the jury, doesn't explain it. It mentions the dollar, doesn't explain it. It mentions the right, the duty, that is, to remain silent, the right, the duty. That's what right means, to speak, freedom of speech, freedom not to speak, at the behest of your maker when he has revealed to you it's best to talk and best not to talk. All of those freight, those words in our Constitution, freight a world of understanding that the people in the American colonies were awash in. They understood that they were different than France and the rest of South America and Mexico and the rest of the world. They were different in that they were the West. No, that wasn't it. We're different than the rest of the West. Not just a little bit, but decidedly. I cringe when I hear people talk about the Western world. Well, that's a little bit of a stretch. We're part of the Western world, but we're markedly different than anything on the continent of Europe and have been for centuries. And what is that? Well, we're a common law country, a law of the land country. There, those countries there, the rest of the world, are law of the city countries. And the Code of Justinian of the old Roman Empire in its various forms governs almost the entire world. Well, with that law, there is no militia law like we have. The ancient Anglo-Saxons called it the Ferd Fair. Ferd Fair. Ferd is their old word. We call it militia. We have taken on a Latin term, unhappily, for it. But the old Anglo, the old English word is Ferd, F-Y-R-D. And fair, we still have that word. We don't use it as much as we used to. It means to be a-going. We talk about welfare. Well, welfare is the well-going of a people. We talk about wayfare. Well, what's wayfare? That's the well-going of a fellow down the road. That's what that is. Fair means a-going. And a Ferd Fair, the Ferd Fair in old Anglo-Saxon speech, is the militia a-going. And we would say in popular military terms today, the militia mobilized. Does that mean the militia didn't exist before it was subpoenaed and mustered and mobile? No. The militia is. You can't get rid of the militia. What is the militia? Again, it's the able-bodied men of a certain vicinage, of a certain juridical entity. For example, and under our Constitution of the United States, our Constitution cites the militia. This is the phrase from our Constitution, the militia of the several states. Well, in Virginia, they're having a bit of trouble down there because the powers that be declared they were going to take everybody's guns. Now, you talk about infringement. What does infringement mean? A well-regulated militia, says the Second Amendment, one, the fourth of the four militia clauses, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right, what is a right in Anglo-Saxon speech? It is a duty. We've hijacked the word in popular use. It has become to mean to most people something selfish. It isn't. That's not what was intended then, and is not what is intended now. The duty, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Keep, that means to keep yourself. That means in older English, not that much older, a keep is something you protect. A keep in the noun form is a castle. To have a keep is to have a castle in old English. To keep something is to safeguard it, to safeguard your arms and your ammunition and your whatever else you need to go with it.
Right.
And to bear, B-A-R-E, that's an older word that means to carry on your person, in your vehicle, to keep and bear arms.
Bear the burden.
Yes, is a duty. Go ahead, Randy.
Well, I just want to say, bear the burden.
Yeah, we use that word some. Yeah, not as widely as they used to use it. Let's go back to another word while we're parsing words, which is important to do with writings of legal significance like the Second Amendment. Regulated, not regulated, but well regulated. Well, what does regulated mean? Well, we have today military men talk about the regular Navy and the regular Army. And they say, guys that are regular, they say, we're regular Navy. We're regular Army. What does that mean? That means we're not reservists. That means we're regular. What does that mean? That means day by day by day, constantly, consistently, never ceasing. We have in our own medical speech, a man, if his body is regular, well, just to put it in a euphemism, if his body is regular and everything's operating regularly, he won't get constipated. Mm-hmm. In other words, regular means free-flowing, mm-hmm. constant, consistent, regular, not stopping. We have commerce that is to be regulated. Why? Because we are, our Constitution has said, we've perverted this too, commerce between the states is to be free-flowing. We used to ditch water out of our fields, and back in the older days, before we had the level of mechanization we have today, we kick our gum boots off after a heavy rain, and we'd walk out into the gumbo, the mud of the field where the little tiny corn plants were, with shovels, and we'd ditch the water off. Now, ditching water off is a skill. And any obstruction in a ditch like that where the land is fairly level, you've got to find the low spots to get the water off. You got to have an eye for it. And you watch, you dig, and the water goes off. But if there's anything in a slow-flowing stream of water like that that inhibits the flow, you got to get it out of there. It just won't work. You got to kick it out, the dirt clod, the stick, whatever it is. Why? Because we wanted the flow to be regular. Regular. We want regular, free-flowing commerce. We want a regular, daily, consistent, nonstop class of men in America that keep and carry guns. That's what the Second Amendment says is not to be infringed.
Well, they've turned that around where regular, you could nowadays swap the word restricted for the way they use the word regular.
I'm just agreeing with you. Hey, try restricting your colon and your intestines. Let's see if that works for you, bub.
Yeah.
Regular means non-restricted. It mm-hmm. means uninfringed. Let's talk about that word. It's important. This is what the courts do when they look at provisions of the Constitution of the United States or any writing of legal significance, any statute. What does it mean to be infringed? Well, if you got fringe, I don't have any fringe on my clothes here. I can show you. The ladies will have fringe sometimes. And the fringe of a thing, more properly, is the edge. The edge of my collar here, the edge of my, if you can see me, I'm assuming you can you?
Oh, yeah. You're okay. Coming through 5x5.
You mean you're listening on the phone. I have an edge to my shirt sleeve here. Fringe means the fruit of the word means the edge of. Infringe means to encroach upon the edge of. The right of the people, the duty of the people. Who are the people? Don't want to miss this either. The people are the militia. The people are the militia. How do I know? Because that's what those that drafted the Constitution of the United States said on more than one occasion at the Constitutional Convention. The people are, I'll quote them. The people are the militia. Some of them said the militia are the people. When the Constitution of the United States says, we the people of the United States, that's the militia. Mm-hmm. Who are the militia? According to common law, the able-bodied men. Somebody says, well, what about the girls? What about the female of the species? Well, does anybody in their honest mind believe that when that was drafted into our Constitution, anybody had the female of our species in mind to go catch bullets? To do much anything respecting government directly? Mm-hmm. No, as a matter of fact, the unity of marriage in those days, as it still is today, we just don't recognize it the way we should. What the man says is what the woman says. They become an item when they get married. Well, what about the women that aren't married? Well, that's another matter. But just to talk about what did it mean, we cannot understand what our Constitution of the United States means now, how it is to be applied now, if we don't first divine and plumb what it meant then. That's the rule of interpretations, again, of writings of legal significance, whether you're talking about the Bible or the Constitution or a statute or anything that's written that has legal import. First, what did it say when it was written? What did it mean to the people that read it as they understood it and as those that drafted it understood it? Well, they understood that women were not bullet catchers. God help us. I would say this too. I want to add this. Any nation that would brook or even much less encourage the female of our species to face bullets and shrapnel is a nation of cowards. I say that frankly and forthrightly. I said that not long ago on public media, and a fellow I had served with, I wasn't a Marine. He was a Marine, but I served with him. But I say again, I'm not a Marine. I had trained with him and served with him, but he said to me, this is what he said. He just spurted this out and said, Brent, why should men do all the dying? And I said, whoa, Nelly, hold your horses, partner. Why should men do all the dying? I'll say it again. Only a nation of cowards would send their wives and their daughters in their place to go face shrapnel bullets, get their legs blown off, and get killed. I don't want to go there. I say now in front of the world, no, 1,000 times no. God says no. I'm not going to say that's okay. That's not okay. That's ugly. And that's cowardice on the part of men. Besides, women have a job that's important that they can't do when they do that, and the whole society would fall apart if it isn't done and it's not being done. And by the way, it's not their fault. Women are loyal, obedient. They'll do anything to help. They're patriotic. Mm-hmm. But we should not say, yeah, you can do that. Listen, the only reason we go to arms, and when we do, the only real worthwhile reason, the God-ordained reason, is protect home and hearth, mm-hmm. or as some people say, hearth. But if there isn't somebody there, the Bible says that the female of the species is to be, the old translations say, keep her at home. That's been a hijacked concept. The Greek word means home guard. My grandmother was home guard, and I have her somewhere around there. Well, the family's got it, her firearms, and she was a very good shot. And woe be it anybody that would encroach upon her garden, her chicken coop, or any creature of any kind. I even saw her shoot her nephew's coon dog one time. She didn't hesitate, and she didn't miss either. Should women be proficient at arms? Yes, I believe they should be as much as possible. If they're prone to want to do that, I think they should. But to be part of that group, that to go out and die and get maimed and get their brains blown out, to kill and be killed on command, no. That's contrary to how God has rightly wired the female of our species and contrary to what he tells us to do. Mm-hmm. Should she know how to shoot? Yes, because she's home guard. She should know how. I had a friend at home that gave his mother a pistol when she was older. And he said, Mom, if anybody ever breaks into our house, I want you to use this at night, and you don't know who it is. She said, what do I do? And she wasn't much on shooting. Mm-hmm. He said, you aim at the center of whatever you see and pull the trigger. And don't let go. And then you run and don't let go of that gun. You don't want anybody to use it on you, but you've got to learn to use it. You never know. And it's getting increasingly that way, as we saw down in Texas just a few weeks ago, when a man entered a Church of Christ down there, and that was a denomination, down there in Central Texas, and just turned and blew 2 men away before an alert and trained man, who, by the way, was a firearms trainer for the military, didn't miss a beat, pulled his pistol and put a slug through his head. Who knows how many lives he saved? He'd already killed 2 men, just bang, bang, like that. Mm-hmm. Should women know how to do that? Yes, but they are not part of the militia of the several states of the United States. That's a false statement, and we should be ashamed of ourselves. Only a nation of cowards would do that. Well, back to the militia, though. What can the female of the species do? Well, there's a lot of things she can do. But the thing that I just mentioned that I'm adamant that she not be charged with is killing on command and being killed by others, by our enemies. Mm-hmm. The militia's there to see that doesn't happen. By the way, the duty of the militia is twofold. And our oath for people who hold public office in America reveals that. It's an ancient oath. It's never interpreted. I never hear people talk about it. I found it as ancient as the 8th and 9th century on the island called England, and even before that, tracing it back to those tribes in Europe. But it goes like this: that I'll defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign and domestic. Mm-hmm. In older times, the oath said, I will defend the land against enemies foreign and domestic. Well, it came to say, I will defend the law of the land. For what is the law of the land? To defend the law of the land is to defend the land, and to defend the land is to defend the law of the land. Mm-hmm. What is the law of the land in the United States? Well, our Constitution doesn't say that the Constitution is the only law of the land. It says the Constitution of the United States, comparatively, that's comparative, is the supreme law of the land. But what is the law of the land? It is our common law. That's what it is. Magna Carta. Back then, that's what they used to call it. Magna Carta used that phrase. We lifted it from Magna Carta, written in the Latin tongue. And Magna Carta, Stephen Langton drafted it. He said, Lex Terra. Lex Terra is the law of the land or land law. Our Constitution of the United States lifts that phrase out and says this Constitution is the supreme, by comparison, law of the land. That means it's our common law expression of government. That's what it means. And what is our common law expression of government? Again, our Constitution of the United States, coming back to the statement of Chief Justice Taft, he's right. It is a brief of common law government. Common law government in, as to use his words, compact draft. We're back to defending the law of the land, but our oath says that I will defend the Constitution of the United States, the law of land, you see, against all enemies foreign, that means as a member of the militia, willingness to take up arms, and domestic. That's defense of the law of land, willingness to serve on the jury. The two duties of our common law, and that means the two duties of the militiaman, government is by the militiaman at bottom, because at bottom what the jury says is not reviewable if the common law due process has been followed. Mm-hmm. By the way, there's another word for our common law and our law of the land, due process. One of the fascinating things about our common law culture, our common law system of measurement, our common law words, our common law itself, is what law of the city lawyers call in the rest of the world, confusion of words. We do that even in our system of measurement, but we do it also in our law. And our common law, again, the reason we do that is because our common law is not a list of laws. It is not built upon precision, not at all. Mm-hmm. It's just the opposite. The law of the city is built upon precision, exact justice, which, by the way, is unattainable among mankind. We exactly. see common law country, we recognize our limitations as mortals. Don't forget, as mortals, we're just mortals. Don't forget, God, in these times, the Bible says, has delegated the government, his government, to men. And he calls this time the day of man. And the day of his government and judgment we call what? The day of God. He uses both of those terms in juxtaposition in the New Testament. But now it's our time. We are not able as men to achieve precise justice. The flaw of the law of the city is everything is precision, everything is logic. That's a flaw. Because logic is not the foundation of truth. Fact is the foundation of truth. Logic then can be used to reason from fact, but they do it the other way around. William Blackstone makes this point in his commentaries, and he was educated in the law of the city, but he was a common lawyer. He knew both systems, and he made it his intelligent choice. But he says, as crazy as it is, and he calls it, he doesn't use that word crazy, but he said it's senseless to put the cart in front of the horse this way and to say that logic comes first, and then you reach fact. That's impossible. But as crazy as that sounds, the whole scholastic world, the whole university world, and he makes the point, even the Pope of Rome, of course, does the same thing. They're under the Code of Justinian, the canon law of the Church of Rome, and they start with logic. Mm-hmm. Logic then eclipses fact. Wherever logic becomes the supreme occupation, facts recede from consideration. I'm quoting Professor Merriman, comparative lawyer from Bolt Hall.
Well, logic is machine language.
That's good. And here's what I forget. It was Llewellyn, I believe. He said he was a legal philosopher in America. he said he called it slot machine justice. Mm-hmm. Slot machine justice, you're seeking precision, you'll never get it. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, then you try to turn it over to the experts to give it to you. You get rid of the jury. The law of the city doesn't use the jury. See, that's one of the things. They don't know. They have experts. Mm-hmm. The priestly caste, whoever that may be, the priest of Rome or the priest of academia, the expert witness, the statistician, he gets on and he gets all the facts, click, 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 slot machine justice. And then he says, here's the, but that will not get you to justice. Why? Because number one, you've put logic before fact, as crazy as that sounds. And number two, men are mortal and limited in their ability, and they're biased. And even in their logic, they will always be biased. Is there anything wrong with bias? It depends upon how you use it, in the good sense or the bad sense. The French were the ones from which we get the word bias. They used it this way. They said that a billiard ball on a billiard table, the cue ball, mm-hmm. if it's biased, even if you hit it with a straight strike, it will slice to one side or the other. Why? Because it's off center in its weight. A billiard ball that's not perfectly centered with its weight around the perfect center of the ball will always go in a direction that physics otherwise wouldn't allow it to go if it were weighted properly. Mm-hmm. And bias was the word they used for that cue ball. Well, that's the way we all are to varying degrees about different things. If we're biased in the right direction and we always skew off toward the law of God, the will of God, the declared will of the sovereign, well, that's good. But most of us, at least at some points, don't do that because we don't even know how the will of God, the law of God, applies in any particular set of facts. So these are the things we're facing when it comes to the militia. I got off on the common law, but our militia, our understanding of the militia, it's the only understanding there is, it's a common law militia. Mm-hmm. And it's a militia that is, it's not a militia that anybody organizes, signs up for, or appoints. You are. And if the state of Illinois or Indiana or Michigan or Montana said, round up every able-bodied man in the state, and we're going to jail them, that won't get rid of the militia. Now you've got the militia, but they're in jail. But back to this oath. Defend the law of the land against enemies domestic. How do you do that as a member of the militia? You serve on the jury. That's mm-hmm. your defense of the law of the land. And defending the law of the land is to defend the land. And what if we have a foreign invader? You're willing to take up arms against enemies foreign. Well, what are you doing there? You're defending the land. Our loyalty as patriots is not to the government of the United States. It's not even to the people of the United States. Patriotism, and that word means fatherland. Patriot is a word that means fatherland. We are to defend our land because God said, I gave it to you, and with jurisdiction over land, from which we get great benefit, comes the duty to defend that land. And that's why our common law militia says what it says. That's why our common law oath for all officers of state and federal government, our Constitution demands it as the law of the land, is substantially the same. It all comes back to the land because at bottom, the land is the subject of the covenant of God with our grandpa Adam. That's where it all comes from. And everything that supports the idea that God provides land for us, tells us to take care of it, tells us to love it because he loves it. He loves it so much that he even applies the Sabbath principle to the land and demands that it be taken care of and let lay fallow every 7 years. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of things that I think are important to understand. Fundamentals about the militia, it's not new. It's not an invention of our Constitution of the United States. It is a recognition that's been in place for years. There are four clauses. Justice Story, I started talking about him at the beginning. He said during that 175 years, at least, I'd have to do the arithmetic. But he said in his commentaries that his great fear was that we will ignore these militia clauses, forget them. And if we forget them, what will happen? We will lose our freedoms. He said this. He said the Second Amendment, and no other country has a law, a militia law like ours. England does. They just ignore theirs. All the English-speaking world does. They're common law countries, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, England, Ireland, Wales, those countries, the United States, and those little protectorates we all have around the world are common law countries. The militia is part of that government, and we have forgotten it, as Justice Story said. And he said, if you do that, then you will have lost the politium and the reality of your freedoms. Mm-hmm. The Palladium, that's an old fancy legal word that means the badge, the sign, the symbol that says you're free. It's the symbol. Mm-hmm. But then also, it is not only the symbol, it is the reality, because without it, I'm reminded, and I want to say this, I don't want to forget, I don't know how much time we got, but I appreciate
it. We got about 30 minutes left here.
Well, just let me say in the middle while I'm remembering it, because of what's going on in Virginia, they're organizing there, and 30 sheriffs, I got word, have said we're not going to enforce these laws if they're put in place of confiscation of firearms, and some there have organized, and I've written a book on the militia, the four militia clauses of the several states. The name of the book is Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, both foreign and domestic. You can find it on Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, and it will come up. There are some places, among other books I've written, but that will come up. It's a little booklet. It's not long, but I try to hit hard and fast. It's a boiling down of all that I've contemplated over the last few decades about the militia and its importance. And I tried to put it in that book. That book is now in a course that some of the militiamen, I don't know that all of them know about it, but in Virginia, are trying to put in place and promote in their state so that people will understand that the militia is not something that just arose with the Constitution, arose with us. No, this is more ancient than our Constitution, more ancient than our common law. This is Bible. Just to make a point about how the militia arose out of the Bible. Our forebears were English Puritans, for example. English Puritans, not to mention the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians and the German and Dutch Reformed groups. And each one of those three groups made up about 1 million people in the American colonies when our country started. Well, there were no more than 3 million people here. Each one of those groups made up about 1 million apiece, give or take. As far as we can tell, 1.6% of the population did not belong to one of those three groups. Now you say, what about the Anglicans? Well, the Puritans were Anglicans, but they were a sect of Anglicans. So I should include the Anglicans and the Congregationalists in that group of English settlers. Mm-hmm. But 1.6% of the population were Romanist. Most of those lived in Maryland. About 0.2% of 1% were Jewish, and the rest of them were Anabaptist and Baptist. That the chief force in America, no question, was what we call today the Reformed point of view. English Puritans, Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, and Dutch and German Reformed people, and many of them lived in Pennsylvania, but they too were scattered throughout the colonies, the German, Dutch population. Mm-hmm. All three of those were biblicists, to the nth degree. Matter of fact, it's been observed, Winston Churchill being one of the men that did it. He may not like Churchill, but he was a good historian. He wrote a lot of books on history. He said the Puritans were the most biblical race of men that ever lived. And somebody says, well, what about ancient Israel of old? Ancient Israel of old was one of the most unbiblical nations that ever lived. Mm-hmm. And the history of the Old Testament is a history of their unfaithfulness and God's faithfulness. Given what they had, and they had a lot that God gave them, they were utterly unfaithful their entire history. But the Puritans, as long as they lasted, they were biblical. The word "the people" in our Constitution of the United States, people say, where does that come from? Why are the militia called the people? Well, the reason for that is this. One of the most oft-appearing or frequently appearing phrases of the Old Testament and coming over into the New Testament, but in the Old Testament Hebrew, is the Hebrew phrase ha'am, ha'am. Sometimes, ami. If you say ha'am, we translate that, the people. If you say ami, that's my people. Both of those phrases appear. And every time that appears, my people, the people, it always refers to a band or a group of armed men. Always. Mm-hmm. And in almost all cases, it refers to the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel. There are a few cases where it refers to the Assyrian militia, for example, and some others. But the word "the people," the phrase "the people," speaks of armed men. It's always a phrase that bespeaks the militia. And it always bespeaks the militia, or not always, almost always bespeaks the militia of the 12 tribes of Israel. And our Puritan forebears, being biblicists, as one fellow said, their blood was bibbling. They couldn't think without thinking of something in the Bible that supported what they were saying, mm-hmm. whether they were right or wrong, but the Bible was their life. And that phrase, the people, is lifted from the Older Testament. And it refers, that's why the founders, we call them the founders, those fellows that drafted the Constitution, mm-hmm. others said the people is the militia, and the militia is the people. That comes from the Older Testament. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's they've done a very good job of getting people to acquiesce their authority to this government structure and basically allow ourselves to become a what you might call a nanny state in so many ways. Yeah, and it's really shameful that we've allowed that to happen, and then now it's the idea of getting people to gather together, organize, without being regulated, but being regular.
Regular. That's good.
And now I understand that you are doing some work with John Dinesh and some of the folks there at National Liberty Alliance and helping them develop some educational materials and things like that so people can become better versed in all of this.
What happened was they said, well, can we just take your book and make a course out of it? And I said, sure, I want to get the word out. Mm-hmm. Take my book and make a course out of it. And so they did. But here's what they did. The simplicity of it was this. They just took my book, and after every section, they put a series of questions to answer. Mm-hmm. So you read the book and then answer the questions, and that's how you study. By the way, that particular method of learning, and I said, I don't know whether you did that on purpose. You think that's best, but that is the best way to learn. One of the popular curriculums that came out during the homeschool movement back in the 80s and 90s was written by a West Point graduate. His last name is Saxon, S-A-X-O-N. And he noticed, he was in the West Point? I believe it was West Point, not Annapolis. But he noticed that when they train men, you know, you take a bunch of young men, 8, 17, 18, 19 years old, mm-hmm. and you put them through diesel mechanic school or nuclear weapons school. And we're talking about some stuff that takes some learning to be able to really put it to use. Mm-hmm. How do you take young men like that and in 6 months give them everything they know in their heads to go out and do what men have been doing for 30 and 40 years? And frankly, it works. They do it. Mm-hmm. I'm shocked even when I think about today how much responsibility is given to boys, just boys, an aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. Aircraft carrier has 1,000, I'm round figure, 1,000 tons of high explosives on board when they're loaded out. That doesn't mean just explosives. That means high explosives of detonation force.
Oh, yeah.
Plus about 1 million gallons or more of highly volatile JP5 high-octane jet fuel. 1 million gallons. Mm. Now, one screw-up in one magazine with a match or a cigarette lighter or a stray piece of voltage, and that ship with all 5,000, 6,000 men, however many, would be vaporized.
It becomes a big mess.
Yeah. And I know you know what I'm talking about because you've told me you've had experience in such places. Now, that's true. And when you stand back, though, and you look at all these boys handling all this high explosive ordnance and all this JP5, you have to stop and ask yourself, how do they get away without blowing up the ship over decades and decades? Well, there are a lot of safety features that are put in place, but there's a lot of education that goes on at the beginning. Well, this education that they use is you listen to a lecture, and as you're listening to the lecture, you're kind of following along in the book. And then at the end, there's a bunch of blanks to fill in to see if you got it. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's that simple. And I told them, I said, if that's all you want to do, that's doing the most you can do. And I want you to do it. And I'm pleased. And they're doing it. And they've about got it done the way here. They've got gals. There's a gal working on this. I've talked to her here the last few days. Speaking of the female of the species, she's an avid shooter. Mm-hmm. She listens to these broadcasts on, by the way, Randy, she saw me on Patriot Soapbox a long time ago when you interviewed me before.
Oh, all right.
And that's how the connection was made with me. You see how important this is, Randy? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you know that, or you wouldn't be doing it. But I'm talking to your listeners too, and it helps me see how important this thing called the internet is for what is right. At any rate, she's writing questions, and she's good at it. She's smart, and I'm going to tell her. Anybody, I don't care how smart you are or how lack of smart you are. Anybody given enough time can write a good book. It just takes time and work. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do it. But it takes a special person to know the right questions to ask. And if you don't ask the right questions, Randy, you don't even have a fair shot at the right answer. And I like to illustrate that from the Bible, too. Jesus Christ told that story that's so famous. People call it the parable of the Good Samaritan. It wasn't a parable at all. It was something that was in the news. All parables begin with the kingdom of heaven is like or as.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't say that. It just starts out and says there was a certain man walked down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And that's part of the language about something that did happen. But the lawyer stood up after he told the story. And he said, it says, seeking to justify himself, he asked a question. That's what lawyers are trained to do, ask questions. Why? Because if you don't ask the right question, you can't get the right answer. You know, I went to law school, get to law exam at the end of the semester, they don't have a list of questions to answer. They have a fact pattern, and you got to ask all the right questions. And the answers you come up with after you ask the questions don't matter. You just got to ask the right questions. That's different than going to med school. They've got to give the right answer. See, that's mm-hmm. It's a whole different deal. Well, this lawyer was a lawyer's Babylonian style, Talmudism, Babylonian Judaism. He stood up and he asked a question. Why? To justify himself, of course. What was his question? Who is my neighbor? Now, I won't tell you the rest of it, but if you go back and read it, Luke chapter 10, getting down there to the later verses, not at the beginning of the chapter, you'll read it there. He said, who is my neighbor? Trying to justify himself and narrow down who his neighbor is so he knows what to do. Justify himself by doing what God said, which is utterly impossible. You do what God said to please God. He justifies you. He does that through his son, Jesus Christ. That's not something you do. But at any rate, he asked this question, who is my neighbor? And in response, Jesus Christ did not answer the question. He asked him another question. He said, well, what does the law say? You're a lawyer. You tell me. He said, love God, love your neighbor. And Jesus Christ mockingly said, oh, go ahead and do that and you'll live. Do that. Knowing full well he couldn't do that. And you got to do it perfectly or it doesn't count. That's mm-hmm. the nature of the law. In the day you sin, you die. If you disobey at one point, says Paul the Apostle, you're guilty of all and worthy of death. Well, we need something more than that. So he said to him, yeah, go ahead. You just do that and you'll live. And then he came at him again. And then Jesus Christ made it clear. And you go back and read it. Ask yourself this question. And this is the right question to ask about that story called the mm-hmm. story of the Samaritan. I'm speaking to our listeners, of course. Ask yourself, did Jesus Christ ever answer that question? And I think you'll find what I found to be true. No, he never did. And what he was saying to this fellow, at the end, when you read it, you have to conclude. He was saying to this lawyer, you're stupid. You're asking the wrong question. You're asking the wrong question. The question is not, who is my neighbor? The question is, who's neighbor to you? Who's being neighborly to you? He's the one you've got to respond to. Of course, Jesus Christ speaking of himself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that goes for all of life. If I sit down and try to catalog who's been neighborly to me, and those are the people that God says I'm supposed to pay attention to, mm-hmm. starting with my mother and father. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to pay attention to them. Why? They're the best neighbors you ever had. Without them, you wouldn't even be here. You say, well, my father was abusive. I still say, without him, you wouldn't even be here. God allowed him to enter into the procreation process, and here you are, and God commands that you respect him and your mother. Well, that's just a starting point. But there are a lot of people. I tried to do this after I understood that parable. I sat down and tried to catalog all the people that have been good to me in my life, good to me, have helped me. Well, the list got so long, I finally realized I'm not going to be able to help all these people, to be kind to all these people. Some of them, I don't even know where they are anymore. Mm-hmm. What can I do? Well, I can turn around and give a cup of cold water to somebody that needs it. I can visit somebody in prison. I can be decent to people that are decent to me now. I want to do that. That's the lesson there. But beyond that, the point I was trying to make initially you got to ask the right question. And that's one of the propositions that that story stands for. Mm-hmm. If you don't ask the right question, what's the right question? Jesus Christ said to Peter, "Who do men say that I am?" Is that the right question? You bet it is. Mm-hmm. "Who do men say that I am?" And what did Peter say? "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." He said, "You didn't reveal this to yourself. God revealed this to you. Men did not reveal this to you." But you got to ask yourself that question. And the answer to that question will dictate your eternity. Mm-hmm. But coming back to the militia, it's true in every area of life. We must ask the right question. Who are the militia of the several states? You got to get that right. Mm-hmm. What are their two fundamental duties? Well, this book you mentioned so kindly, the one that I wrote, that's what these folks are doing. They're taking that book and they're asking questions at the ends of the chapter to help people learn, as Mr. Saxon did with Saxon Math, that homeschool curriculum that he fashioned after what we've learned after about 4,000 years of having military life among us, how to train young men to act quickly and save their lives and the lives of others and then and the existence of their own country. Back to you, Randy.
The book, is that on your website, Common Lawyer?
It is. It's on the website with very much of a description of it there.
The Militia of the Several States?
The Militia of the Several States, right. And the book, though, that has the curriculum with it, when that gets done, that will be available, I think, at mm-hmm. the NLA website, National Liberty Alliance. Mm-hmm. And but we haven't worked out those details yet, but I know that this curriculum is, and I had a lady call me from Wyoming. Here we are, the ladies again, right? A friend. She'd been a Girl Scout almost 50 years. Did I lose you, Randy?
No, I'm here. I'm doing.
Oh, I see what you're doing. That's nice of you.
I'm showing your book here.
She had been a Girl Scout for almost 50 years. She knows everybody in the state of Wyoming. And she is now hot to trot to teach a course not only on the militia of the several states, but the Constitution. And the young Republicans of her state, some of them have contacted her and wanted to do that. And I said, "Listen, I want to get you this book." Because she was panicked. She said to me she didn't feel like she knew what she could do. I said, "You need a curriculum. Let's get one to you." Mm-hmm. So she wants to do that. In politics, Randy, when I was in politics, we had a saying, and we called it the 5 W's. The 5 W's. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the girls. And the 5 W's of politics are this, and it applies pretty everywhere. When women work, we win. When women work, we win. Mm-hmm. What do men do? They talk a lot in politics. But look at us, Randy, how we're talking.
Oh, yeah.
Is it important? Yes, it's talk. It's important. Talk radio, all the talking the men do. But women are more practical minded. I learned in politics, and I was taught this by people that made it a matter of study. If I couldn't tell a woman something to help her get through her day today, she's not going to listen to me. Why? Because women are practical. It's got to work. Mm-hmm. Men aren't as practical. No, they aren't. Men say it's the other way around. It's not. Let me tell you something else I've discovered about women. I have 5 daughters.
Why? you got a good lesson going there.
Oh, boy. When it comes to women, people say, "Well, women aren't logical. They're emotional." No. Just the opposite is true as a matter of emphasis. Men are logical, can be, but women are more logical. Their minds are more practical, more steel trapped. But the difference is this. The Bible says this. The woman lacks the discernment when it comes to fact that the man has. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. But don't ever neglect, once you know what you think the facts are, don't neglect to listen to your wife. Her mind will work as a better oiled machine than yours. I've learned that over the years. That's the way God did it. He did it on purpose. He did it on purpose, and without both of those, we both fall down.
It's a balancing act. Side by side, one supports the other. Without both, you're unbalanced.
You stand and fall together. That's right. So we need our mothers. We need our sisters. We need our wives. We need our friends, like that friend I talked about in Wyoming and this mm-hmm. gal that's helping put together our curriculum. But I must say also, only a nation of cowards would send their gals out to catch bullets and shrapnel and to die in their place. And we've done that. That's the degeneracy of our own country. Let's grow up, boys and girls. Grow up. Know what God says. Because if we don't follow His, He's the only true lawgiver, and His fundamentals of law never change, and it will be our destruction. When the Bible says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, what knowledge is He talking about? He's talking about the knowledge of obeying God. Mm-hmm. There is no other knowledge. The knowledge of the Old Testament, Yada, Yada, is always experiential. It is the experience of obedience that is the Christian life. Not the experience of waving your hands in the air, getting emotional. Is there anything wrong with emotion? No. Your joy will bubble up in you as you learn to obey your Maker. That's where the joy comes from. And believe me, I speak from personal experience. I've learned it over the years, and I'll learn more when as time moves on. That joy is deep, and it's rooted deep, and it won't go away. Back to you, Randy.
Well, I'll tell you what. When you are working with the Lord and working with a godly woman, I, being three times divorced and probably not going to go there again. I've learned some lessons. I wish that worked out differently, but you see some of these folks who were the husbands and the wives work closely side by side with each other, and it's amazing how successful the family becomes in that and in all things. And then, I've spoken myself several times about the idea of honor thy father and mother. And you do that in your actions and what how you present yourself, because you are a reflection of them. And the same thing is with God. We are a reflection of Him, and it's our actions by people judge. They look at us, and through us, they discern. Is this person saying they're godly, or are they godly? Are they believers? Are they standing up with the Word? It all fits together there, and I love that message that you were bringing there. That's awesome.
Oh, it's beautiful. And once you leave it, as our culture has, the people that call themselves God's people, they don't hear it. Mm-hmm. The reason they don't hear it, because nobody's teaching it. Nobody, well, not very many. I'm sure there are a few. I shouldn't say that, but very few. And then, but it's a slide off into madness. Once you reject the standards of what is right, mm-hmm. that God has given us, we will go about substituting, as Paul the Apostle says, I'm quoting him, our own right wiseness. Mm-hmm. The translations say righteousness. That means right wiseness. Our own ideas of what's right. We call that morality. Yes. The mores of a people. Well, those change from day to day. They don't mean anything.
Well, look at our schools. Our schools are out there actively working against the family, against the parents. They're turning the children against their parents, which is if there was anything more evil as far as how to destroy a society, that in itself is so absolutely over the top, just pure evil. When you start trying to tear down the family, and that's been a lot of the problem is our schools, and even some our political organizations and everything is designed to divide and conquer. And if you can split the children from the parents at a very early age, then yeah. Oh my gosh, you've got a generational problem there that is going to not get better.
Randy, people say, when we talk like this, mm-hmm. people get worked up, rightly so. What can I do? I've had that question asked a lot. I'm going to give you a practical. Try to be practical, like the gals teach me to do. Mm-hmm. First thing you do is, if your mother or father, or both of them are still alive, you call them and tell them you appreciate them, number one. Number two, if they're not alive, tell somebody else how much you appreciated your parents. Oh, I know they've got problems. Mine do too. Mine are still alive. I'm very fortunate. I'm going to call my mother and father again today. Well, I got a chance. They're not young anymore. But do that. Yep. Why? Because that's the foundation of all government, is respect of parents. Absolutely. You know, the fifth commandment is says, honor thy father and thy mother. And it's the only commandment that's truly a commandment, number one, an imperative form of the verb. But Paul the Apostle says it's the preeminent commandment. It's not the first in the list, but it's the most important. If you can't do that, you can't do anything else that God wants you to do. So yeah. Do that first, and then go out and buy yourself a military-grade weapon, if you're a male, a military-grade weapon, and 500 rounds of ammunition, and then seek and complete a firearms safety and marksmanship course. Mm-hmm. Because if you're a member of the militia, if you're born that way, you're an able-bodied man, you have a duty to do that. And then stand by and wait. Wait for your legislature, your governor, and let them know somehow, get in your county and let the governor know, we're here if you need us. Let your sheriff know, we're here. We're the posse comitatus. We're the posse. We're here if you need us. Yeah. I've seen the posse in action. It's amazing. It's catching on. Go ahead.
If I may, because you're talking about parents and things like that. And I had an experience just yesterday. I get a call from my mom. We had about seven, 8 inches of snow yesterday.
Yeah.
And she's asking, hey, which gas can am I supposed to pour in the snowblower and that? And I said, well, Mom, I'll be over. You know, I live 5 minutes away by car. Okay. And, so we'll get your snowblower up and running and everything. So I get over there.
Yeah.
And this is 43 minutes. Let me show you what she's up. My mom is 86 years old. Okay, okay. Watch this.
What are you doing?
Well, I'm just cleaning out my working.
Uh-huh. Well, let's get that snowblower yours fired up. Let's see if we can get through some of this. I've seen a couple of people using snowblowers like yours, so we might. I didn't even try it with mine, but
okay.
You're in video right now.
Oh, well, good.
Say hi, because I'm going to share this on the channel.
Oh.
We talk about you occasionally.
Winter's wonderful.
All right, Mom.
Okay.
That's my mom. 86.
86 years old, and she couldn't wait for me to get there. She grabbed her shovel, and the whole time, you know, I got the snowblower running, and I'm clearing her driveway, and she's still shoveling.
Yeah.
Okay. You got to appreciate it.
Oh, no. I'm amazed she got strong enough back to do that. I got to be careful doing that, Randy.
Oh, I tell you what. I love my mom. She's wonderful. So I thought everybody would get a kick out of that. So I got a lot to live up to, man.
Well, Lord willing, at 86, you can do that.
Yeah. I hope so. I absolutely hope so. So, well, we're at the top of the hour here, Brent. I want to thank you again for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, and we'll have to do it more often. And any last comments, statements, or whatever there?
Oh, of course. Thank you, Randy. Just go to commonlawyer.com and get that book, The Militia of the Several States. You'll see other books there that are available, too, including a translation of the Bible from the original tongues that might interest you. If you are, you can go to email me if you have trouble getting any of these books. On that website, go to the contact page, and you can email.
Excellent. Yeah, I've been putting the link to your website out there while we've been chatting. And again, thank you so much, sir. You enjoy the rest of your day. God bless.